Senator, thanks for having us, and welcome back to Morning Edition.
Thank you very much, Dennis. Great to be with you.
We've heard throughout this forum people talking about causes of radicalization that require almost individual solutions, grassroots, person-to-person solutions, and really non-military ones. And yet we are in a campaign against ISIS where we have used drone strikes and other military measures. Can military efforts really hinder the kind of slow person-to-person work that needs to be done?
Of course, we have to protect ourselves, and our military power and our military forces working with allies on the ground and friends on the ground in the Middle East and other challenging places where we have such extremism, violent extremism, it's absolutely essential. So there's no diminishing of the military tool in terms of the near term. In the long run, we've got to work with the Muslim world. In the long run, it's a battle within the Muslim world. They've got to have the Muslim moderates around the world have to save their own nations. They have an existential threat. Terrorism is a threat to us. It is not an existential threat. In those countries, particularly in the Middle East, they have an existential threat. So the long-run answer is for them to take on the radicals in their own ranks and to create a better life for their people. And the two go together.
Part of the narrative, though, particularly in this campaign, has been that those nations are not doing enough. Are they doing more than the perception is that they're doing?
I think they're doing more than they did last year and doing more than they did the year before. Are they doing enough? No. There's a lot that's got to be done, including changing the education system. The education system right now is not producing skills and is also producing a lot of radical ideas. So the education system is fundamental. Some of that's beginning to happen. They have to have better governance. They have to have more honest governance. It doesn't have to be a pure democracy. It doesn't have to be a U.S.-style system. But it has to deliver services to people. It has to give people a chance to get educated. It has to have a system that provides justice to people. May not be American exact-style justice, but it's got to give people hope. A lot of young people in that part of the world simply don't have hope.
But is there anything then the U.S. can do to push that process of those governments doing more farther along?
I think we need to have a lot of conversations with those governments. I think we need to make sure that they understand that our long-term support depends on them making changes to help their own people. We need to give them military support where we can. But in the long run, we have to say to them, you have a responsibility here. It's your nation. It's your religion. We can't cure the problem for you. We'll help you wherever we can, but you've got to step up to the plate. You've got to own the problem.
There are outside actors, though. We are one of the biggest. Russia is another, especially when it comes to Syria. Is there any way that we can come up with a solution without, to some degree, and however reluctantly, working with Russia?
I think it's true in the Middle East, and I think it's true also in Europe and Ukraine. We have to work with Russia. We have to find a way to begin to rebuild trust. The trust between the United States and Russia is at a low that probably was not exceeded even during the Cold War. And that's pretty serious. And it's serious when we're involved in close proximity with military forces, both in the Syria regional arena as well as in Ukraine and NATO. It's also serious when you have two countries that have an existential stake in each other's warning systems, making sure we don't have any kind of mistake, making sure we don't have an escalation that leads to some kind of mistaken launch or some sort of false warning. So we have a huge amount at stake with Russia. Do we trust them? No. Do they trust us? No. Should we begin to communicate a lot more? Yes. One of the things I would like to see my good friend for many years, Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, strike up much more of a communication pattern with his counterpart in Russia, even if he doesn't trust him. And I think that he ought to encourage our military leaders, like our NATO commander, to have discussions with his counterpart. These kind of discussions are absolutely essential. When you don't trust each other, you've got to communicate more, not less. And that's the situation, not just for the U.S., but it's also the situation for Russia. They have a huge stake here, too. They have a much bigger Muslim population than we do. And if you look at the borders with the Russians, they have a huge threat with their own Muslim population that may be radicalized. So we have a lot to work together on, and that rebuilding of trust is, I think, one of the essential tasks that the next president's going to have to face.
Now, he hasn't given very many specifics about his plan for combating terrorism, but one of the themes of Donald Trump's campaign has been closer cooperation with Russia. You're a lifelong Democrat. Is he on to something here, though?
Well, I'm not in the Putin fan club, and I'm not sure quite where Mr. Trump is coming from, whether it's a personality. He basically said the reason he's saying that is because Putin said something nice about him. So sometimes people are inadvertently correct, and I think he's on to something in terms of the communication, but the reasons for it seem to me to be more ego-driven than policy-driven. Nevertheless, bottom line is we do have to communicate with the Russians much more than we're doing now, and we have to rebuild that trust. One of the things that I have been advocating both in Russia and the United States is the simple but very dangerous radiological threat, dirty bomb. That material, dirty bomb material, is located in areas where ISIL is located and where they're controlling hospitals and other places. And Russia faces a dirty bomb threat. We face one. It would not be a Hiroshima. It would not be a nuclear explosion, but it would deny access, could, to crucial areas like ports or airports for years and sometimes even decades if you had the right kind of material go off in those areas. So I've said and continue to push, so far without success, to get our government and the Russian government to simply announce we're going to have our intelligence agencies work together and we're going to have our energy departments work together to locate and secure and work with governments all over the world to secure all the radiological material that we possibly can. I think that's crucial to our security and crucial to the Russian security.
Can they possibly work together politically without running the risk of, let's say, them getting information we don't want them to have?
Well, you're not going to meet in the top secret rooms of the CIA or in the KGB or their counterpart in Moscow. You're going to have meetings in neutral territories. You're going to be able to, I think, have the kind of communication on limited subjects. We certainly are not going to share our deepest secrets, nor are they. We've got professionals in intelligence services on both sides, and if the president's decide that that's the direction to move in, if the U.S. president and the president of Russia, I'm completely confident that our intelligence agency will not only work together, but will understand the reason for it. And the same thing is true with our energy departments. You've got to have not only intelligence, but you've got to have experts in understanding which of these radiological materials are the most dangerous, where they're located, and how we go about securing them.
Here in Atlanta, we have at least one place where there's some dangerous substances. They're not radiological, they're biological. The Centers for Disease Control, for instance. We also have critical infrastructure at the airport. If we are making the kind of progress against ISIS that precludes them from staging big operations, and we're more at risk from individual actors in this country, do you feel we've done a good job at protecting not just those two things here in Atlanta, but other critical installations around the country?
Well, the bio threat is going to be one that our children and grandchildren work on, and it's one that we've got to work with not just Russia, but China and other major powers on. It's a threat to all of us because if you create some type of disease, whether it's man-made or whether it's Mother Nature, it doesn't stop at the borders. It can spread across the borders, and when you may want to strike down your enemy, you may also kill your own families. So the biological threat is serious. The Russians did, the Soviets did, a huge amount of work on that, including weaponization. Back in the Soviet days, they know an awful lot about it. And again, this is one of those areas we've got to communicate with the Russians on. I would say the same thing, even more difficult, in the digital world. You know, the cyber world has created a huge number of problems, brought a lot of blessings to society, but a lot of challenges too. And my organization just had 2 days of meetings on the cyber threat to command and control and to warning systems so that, God forbid, we ever have any country with nuclear weapons that gets false warnings and you end up going to some type of war by mistake with nuclear weapons. That's the ultimate nightmare. But everything becomes more dangerous in the cyber world, and this is one that countries have to find ways to work together on. Your earlier question about intelligence cooperation, it causes there are a lot of classified areas here, but there are ways to work around that. It just has to be done by people in the professional communities that understand the importance of it and are willing to use innovation and creativity to have the essential cooperation you need, even in the classified world.
How far behind the curve do you think we are in developing that kind of cooperation?
I think we're a scale of 1 to 10, we're somewhere around 2, 10 being where we need to go. So we got a long, long way to go. And when I say we, I'm not talking about just the United States and just Russia. You got countries like India and Pakistan that are enemies, that both are heavily armed, and even 100 weapons, and they've got several hundred weapons going off between India and Pakistan, even if it was by mistake, would threaten the whole world and the environment of the world. So it's not simply the United States and Russia. We're probably further ahead than other countries, but we got 9 countries now with nuclear weapons, and the world gets more dangerous, and digitization and cyber type attacks and false warnings created by cyber and hacking, that sort of thing, is something that our nuclear forces have to work on every single day. And they are working on it. It's not that we're asleep on it. It's just that the technology is changing more rapidly than anybody imagined, and that the policy has a hard time keeping up with the technology.
Very quickly, that brings up North Korea, which has conducted extensive and more advanced nuclear tests over just the last year, even. If we continue to isolate North Korea, though, are we running the risk that they will look at their assets that could bring them revenue, like nuclear materials, and say, hey, we can sell them to anyone in the world, including the very people we've just been talking about, the terror groups?
That is a grave danger. I've worried more about the North Koreans selling their nuclear technology than I did about Iran, even when they had a program in Iran before we reached this agreement, and I still worry about that. The overall approach with North Korea, again, has to be to communicate with them, to talk with them. We can have informal talks now. We ought to encourage that. We ought to try to get them back to the negotiating table. That is a very difficult job.
Politically difficult, isn't it?
Politically, and we need to get Russia and China to help on that, and our allies, South Korea and Japan, all of them got to play a role in it. Fundamentally, we've got to work with China. China is threatened in the region if North Korea continues to develop their weapons.
But China has done very little so far.
China has done some things, but not nearly enough. China is a country that has the most leverage and the most relationship with the North Koreans because we don't trade with them now, so we don't have much to cut off. So we need to talk to the North Koreans. We need to get the Chinese very, very involved. And we also need to increase our deterrence with Japan and South Korea. We've got to beef up our military forces so that North Korea knows without any certainty that an attack, even if it's not a nuclear attack, will be met with a vigorous, proportionate but vigorous response. Finally, I would say we've got to enforce the U.N. resolution that passed this spring. I think the Obama administration deserves some credit for getting that passed. China voted for it. It's U.N. Resolution 2270, and it gives all countries the legal obligation to stop conventional or any kind of nuclear technology from coming in or out of North Korea. It means that countries are fully empowered, authorized, and even directed by the U.N. Security Council resolution to search ships and airplanes coming in and out of North Korea. That's a very powerful resolution. It's a strong sanction. It is not being adequately implemented now by any country. And one of the things that former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Mike Mullen and I just recommended last week was that that resolution be implemented and that the United States lend its support, intelligence, and otherwise to our friends in the region, including Southeast Asian nations, so that they will be able to properly and professionally implement this resolution.
And you just said we need to beef up defenses that South Korea has and that Japan has. If we're trying to get cooperation from China, though, with North Korea, how can we do that? Because they're not going to be too thrilled with more defenses for South Korea and Japan.
Well, that's true, and China has to understand that we're going to have an approach. We need to do all these things in parallel. And if China cooperates with the United States, we have a chance to avoid war and to have a peaceful, stable, denuclearized Korean Peninsula. If we don't, then the steps we have to take will not be well received by China. I think all these steps have to be parallel. Talking to North Korea, getting them back to the negotiating table, working with China in every way possible, enforcing the UN resolution, beefing up our defenses. It's not one or the other. It's not sequential. We need to do them all parallel, and we need to have a degree of urgency with that.
Can it wait till after the election, though? Because complicated solutions like this are not exactly bumper sticker material.
Well, we're in a bumper sticker era right now, and we're in a bumper sticker election. So I would say that I would hope this administration that's in power now, who are not out there running, the Obama administration, will do some vigorous, quiet, behind-the-scenes laying of a foundation for the next president, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. Either one are going to face this very significant, growing, and I think grave danger.
One quick political question. In the U.S. Senate race, you, I believe, have said you're supporting Johnny Isaacson. He's a Republican, certainly one with whom you've worked over the years. Your own daughter just ran for the Senate as a Democrat. What would you say to Democrats who say, gee, Senator, we could use your help here?
Well, I'm not terribly partisan, and of course I've been chastised by some of my Democratic friends for that over the years, but fortunately they tolerated me because I believe putting country before party. Johnny Isaacson has been a friend of mine for a long time. When I went to Cobb County the first time in 1972, pretty Republican county, my campaign manager at that time rented a great big ballroom that would have held about 600 people. There were about eight people there. Johnny was one of them. So that friendship goes back a long way. I'm not getting very involved in the race, but I do think Johnny Isaacson's a good man, and he's been a friend a long time.
So it's less about Jim Barksdale and more about Johnny Isaacson?
Nothing about negative about our Democratic nominee. I'm sure he's a very honorable man and has had a good business career. So this is simply a matter of friendship, longstanding friendship. And when you run the race I did in 1972 and there were eight folks in the room that would have held 400 people, you don't forget that.
Former Senator Sam Nunn, thank you so much for being with us again and giving us this time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.